Hello, everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode 289. And we are live on Odyssey, DLive, Rumble, and Entropy. Please do the right thing. Share these locations on places like Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all the places I can't share them because I'm the most deplatformed man in the UK. And I'm lucky enough to be joined tonight by the most deplatformed man in Australia, who I'll be introducing shortly. Now, I've got loads of exciting things coming up later in the week. On Friday, I've got a pre-recorded video, which is an in-depth breakdown of the demography of UK schools. And I think even the most black-pilled of nationalists will be shocked about how bad British schools are and how early that some of those schools or entire year groups will be ticking over to majority ethnic minority. So white Brits are going to be a minority in schools, but much sooner than I thought, actually. And I've got a whole video coming out on this on Friday with all the government statistics laid out, why this is important. Check that out. It's going to be really good. That'll be out 1 p.m. on Friday. I've still got a video out from last week about what really happened in Amsterdam with all of the Jews that apparently had to be airlifted to safety and definitely didn't do anything wrong. Don't believe the media narrative. Check out my video. That's the got the truth about that. Then on Friday, I'll be live with Dr. David Duke at 4 p.m. And on Sunday night, we've got a special episode of the Book Club because we're joined. I think it's Book Club this Sunday. Let me just check. Yeah, it's the last Sunday of the month this month. It's a weird month because the last day of the month falls on a Saturday. So we've actually got Book Club coming up this Sunday, and we've got Keith Woods on, and we're reviewing Keith's new book. So look forward to that. Now, if you've shared this stream, if you've liked it, that's great. But what's even better is if you can support this stream. Now, you can send super chats via Entropy or Odyssey, or you can send them on Rumble as well. If you like my work, if you appreciate the stuff that I do, if you think what I do is worthy of support, please do give a super chat, $3, $5, $10, or whatever you can afford. As you know, all of my work is provided free of charge. All of it goes to you without any paywall. It's all available for free on the internet, including my book. So if you like what I do and you want me to keep doing it, please do consider making a donation. And also keep your eyes peeled for new announcements about our prisoner support fund. I've been on the phone to several prisoners' families this week and we'll be making some announcements in the run-up to the end of the week about families that we have supported financially through that program. We've now raised over £17,000 for those families. So thank you to everybody who has contributed to that as well. So if you want to contribute to the stream, you can do so via Odyssey or Entropy or through Rumble. And you can also donate, obviously, via cryptocurrencies. All my crypto links are in the description below. And finally, if you want to write to me, you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. So that's all the intro stuff. So now I'm going to introduce the living legend himself, the most deplatformed man in Australia, Blair Cottrell. I had the pleasure of meeting this guy recently. He came over to our conference near the end of October. It was a fantastic weekend. It was absolutely brilliant to get to meet him and spend a few days with him. I actually wish I could have spent more time with him. I wanted to be able to go to the gym with him, actually, and do some training or some physical activity. But he had lots of sightseeing to do. He gave a great speech at the conference. So it was a real boost to get him over here and for people to meet him. And there was a long queue of people asking for pictures to be taken, etc. And Blair also had some interesting observations about London. So, Blair, how are you doing, my friend? Did you enjoy our conference? We'll talk a bit more about that, obviously, later in the show. And what did you make of the UK?
Well, it's the first time I'd left Australia. It was a long flight, and I didn't stay long enough. I can tell you that. I was there for 8 days total, and I didn't count on being so fatigued, thrown around by the long flight. So I only got to spend a single day in London, but I think a day was long enough to see that it's a city that seems to be overrun, and it has its own sort of degree of problems. But the event was great. It was awesome to meet everybody. It kind of threw me back, actually, because some people I met, they were familiar with some of my content from years and years ago, stuff that I'd forgotten about. And it made me realize how long I've been in this community and how long I've been chipping away at current established ideas, how long I've been sharing stuff. So it was very humbling to have so many people know who I was and want to meet me, want to get photos with me. And I really appreciated the invitation. It was the first time I'd been to a conference that was that well polished. I have to say the camera work was excellent. The organizing was great. The audio, so few times do people get the audio on point. Like, it's hard to get a microphone to sound the way you want it to sound. But look, long story short, this guy sitting here on this stream with me now, if you're watching this live, if you're watching it on repeat, this guy knows how to put a conference together. And he's also a guy who's always hard at work in this community. He's always looking for the next job, the next task he can do to assist anyone in the community who needs help. When he's not doing that, he's organizing protests, conferences, he's streaming. And then in addition to that, behind the scenes, he spends hours and hours of his time on the phone networking with people all around the world who are significant or important to the community in some way. I can't fault this guy, Mark. So if you can support this stream, if you can support Mark and the work he's doing, make sure you do it. Give as much as you can. He's just a guy that we need more guys like Mark in the community. After meeting you personally and seeing how busy you are, how busy you keep yourself with the kind of work you do, yeah, it made me appreciative that you were giving me your time, you know.
Well, mate, I've got to say they're some of the kindest words anyone's ever said about me. But I've got to say the same for you. When you came over, we were all so hyped to meet you. And our conferences are sort of very laid back. They're not like these conferences where you have 8, 9, 10 speakers and there's no chance to meet people because it's just constantly like being in a lecture. And our conferences are structured. So the speeches are shorter. There's plenty of time between speeches. Speeches are given in blocks of two rather than big sort of 3, 4 speeches in a row. And it was a lovely day. And seeing you surrounded by so many people who were so excited that you were there, because I remember, you know, keeping it all undercover that you're coming over, getting you into the country. I remember the morning you landed. I remember saying to the wife, I was like, God, I'm so nervous. He's just landed. Is he going to get through customs, et cetera, et cetera? And when you text me and you're like, basically, the eagle has landed. I'm in the country. You know, I'm getting on public transport. I'm going to go to my hotel. I'm very tired, but I'm here. And when we advertised that you were coming, people were so hyped because the stuff that you do in Australia and the admiration people have for you, because you've been doing this for a long time now, you've stuck at it, you've always been that strong voice in Australia that people can sort of turn to, you know, for all sorts of things. I think people were overwhelmed that you were there. And the biggest buzz for a lot of the people was basically being able to get to shake your hand, have 5, 10 minutes of your time, and, you know, have a picture with you. And some of our guys went away so hyped because they've watched all your streams. They're a massive fan of your fitness tips, of your honesty relating to your fitness. And these guys have, you know, modeled a lot of what they do on you. You know, you're a huge influence, you know, all over the Anglosphere because of the way you carry yourself. And I've got to say, if I have one regret about the conference, it was that you and I didn't get sort of a day or 2 days together where we could go, where we could maybe train for a bit, go for sort of like a sort of a private dinner, chat more and actually get to know each other. And it was also disappointing because I really would have enjoyed introducing you to, you know, the wife and my daughter, because you are somebody that, you know, I do view as one of the most important nationalists in the world. And to be able to get you into the UK and to see the left go absolutely mental about it, it was brilliant. I just wish we'd had more time with you. And obviously now we're doing this press-up challenge at the moment. And that was something else I wanted to bring up with you, because you are somebody who inspires people when it comes to fitness and masculinity. But How's it going for you doing the push-ups?
Well, first of all, yeah, we didn't really get a lot of time to hang out over there. It's like we were both in character the whole time because we had lots of people around us. We had lots of stuff to do. I could see that you were on a tight schedule too, and you were actually in charge of organizing not just the event itself, but transporting persons to and from the event and putting those persons in hotels, which you had organized yourself, getting the persons from the hotels to the event, to the airport and so forth. And I was looking for an opportunity to sort of just get a moment to hang out with you, but we'll have to organize that in the future sometime because it was just too busy. But the push-up challenge, look, this is an honor-based challenge, meaning you've got to be honest about the amount of press-ups that you're doing, right? And I capped out about a week ago at 3,000. And this is because 18 months ago, I had my pectoral tendon surgically reattached on my right side. And it started hurting. It started feeling really painful at about the 3,000 mark. Well, at about 2,000, I was feeling the pain and I was trying to push through it. I was punching out between 350 and 400 a day, roughly. And some days there was a bit less than that, but I was adding it all up. And I was really excited. I was making time-lapse video of all the push-ups I was doing. So like I'd move really fast in the footage, but I wanted to sort of provide some evidence that I'd actually done it. But I'm sorry to say I've had to cap out. I might try to get back in there and do as many as I can before the month's out because the pain seems to have subsided. But that tendon that I had to get reattached has become a bit of a weak point. I'm old now. I have injuries. I have niggling little pains that I have to deal with. 10 years ago, I would have done the 9,000 already, I think. But, you know, that's just life. How are you going with it, Mark?
Well, I hit 12,000 today. I've been doing 600 a day consistently. And once I'd hit my 9,000, I was like, I'm just keeping going. I'm trying to get 18,000 done. And I've got to admit, I'm 44. So it's probably one of the last years where I'm going to do a big fitness challenge like this and really like shoot for the moon. But my right pec is starting to hurt. My elbows ache a little bit if they're going to be cold.
Are you feeling the pain in there? Is the pain in the from the front of the shoulder region?
The pain's just there.
That's the tendon. Yeah. So yeah. Because mine's shredded and being surgically stitched back onto the bone, it just became really inflamed after about 2,500. And I was like, yeah, I can't really, because there is a chance when you've had a tendon surgically reattached, there's actually a pretty significant chance it can rip off again. And if it does, it kind of stays off. It's too shredded for them to stitch it back on a second time, usually. So I just didn't want to risk that for the sake of a number. But yeah, sorry to disappoint, guys.
Well, look, mate, I don't know. Can you hear this? Let me tell you if you can hear this. Could you hear that sort of little crack? You might not have been able to. It might not have picked it up on the mic.
Do it again. Do it again. I'll see if I can hear it.
It won't do it again. Once you've done it once, but every time I straighten my arms the whole way, I don't know if the mic will have picked that up. But you hear this little stuff. I can hear this little pop. And it's like, oh, God. But I'm going to try and keep going. I've obviously got 10 days left to do another 6,000. And if I can make it through, I'll be really happy. But at 44, I'm going to say,
Hey, it's impressive. It's Mark, are you a competitive guy? Are you someone who likes to win? Yeah, yeah. I think you might have this one in the bag because that's a lot of press-ups.
Well, the problem is I'm not going to win it. There's a couple of guys, one called LDN Nat and another called Connor B, and I'm shouting them out. They've been doing about 1,000 a day. So they've been doing more than me. But I am very competitive, and I'm one of those guys that can stick in for the grind. So we did a hike, which was like 20, I think it was about 24 miles long. It was the Yorkshire Three Peaks Challenge. And I bust my foot about just after halfway, and I could feel the toe bleeding in the shoe. And I was not stopping for breaks because I was moving too slowly. And in the end, I got ahead of people because everyone else was stopping for breaks and then catching up with me. But I just kept pushing on. And one of the young lads stopped Sam at the final ascent and said to him, he says, Mark's clearly in real pain. You can see him wincing. He said, do you think he's going to make it? I'm a bit worried about him. And Sam just looked at him and says, you don't know him. He will get up there whether it kills him. He says, Mark is just so filled with the desire to not give in. He'll levitate up that hill if he has to. And obviously I did it, and later on two of my toenails fell out. It was absolutely grim. And
wow.
The worst thing about it was my car's got heated seats. And I got in my car and I turned all the heated seats on and the heaters. And it's like getting a back massage. You sort of like really relaxed. And I was like, oh, I'm fine. And I rang my dad and I was like, look, Dad, I've done it. Knocked it out of the park. I'm feeling great. I'm all snug and cozy in the car. And then when I got out the car at the other end and the cold air hit me, my whole body just went into shock. And I was just sort of this quivering wreck. And I had to get in the shower and have like a, you know, like a 34, 35 degree shower just to, you know, heat myself back up. But I will never give in. And I just can't stand. That's why I like doing the long distance running and long distance cycling and stuff, because it's as much mental as it is physical. And I know that I'm not physically as strong as someone like you. I'm not kidding myself. But what I lack in sort of size and power that you have, I try to make up for in just sheer bloody mindedness. That's my superpower. Just not.
It's very English. I feel like I'm being like tested or warned or something, because the guys down here, they host weightlifting competitions every year. And the last 2 years in a row, I sustained injuries trying to win. Usually I get quite competitive myself and get really fired up about the idea of winning. But the 2 years ago, I tore my pec tendon off, which was a significant injury. And then just was it earlier this year or last year? I think it may have been earlier this year, yeah. I had like a quadricep tear during a squat. It wasn't as debilitating as the first injury, but it was enough to put me out for the day. And now with this 9,000 push-up challenge, I've been feeling so much pain in my tendon reattachment point where I got the surgery. I've had to stop, and I'm thinking, I would just like to see something through to the end. Like, for 3 years, I haven't been able to finish a challenge. But yeah, it's just something that comes along with pushing your body to its limits for so long. I think the connective tissue really starts to suffer. And then you have issues with connective tissue. Your muscles are strong. Like, I feel like my muscles are strong. But all the tendons, ligaments, I think they've been put under such stress for so long that they're starting to show wear and tear. But that's just what happens, isn't it?
Well, it's interesting. Like, I'm not claiming to be at your level in terms of weightlifting or anything, but I used to be very good at sort of 10K and half marathons. And I hit a point about 35, when I was about 35, pushing maybe just 36. I think it was 35 or, yeah, 35, I think it was. And I went out for a run on a Sunday morning. It was a very, very chilly morning, a little bit of ice on the ground. Nothing that was really too bad or that should have shook me, really. And certainly nothing to slip on, and I didn't slip. But it was quite a cool morning, and I always preferred running when it was like that, because you don't overheat. Like, it's harder running in sort of 38, 40 degrees than it is running at 2 or 3 degrees. So I set off, and I feel this little twinge in my calf, and I think to myself, that's nothing. I've run these off before. So I carry on running, expecting it just to go. And eventually it was getting worse and worse and started to be actually not just uncomfortable, genuinely painful. So I ended up walking home and having a hot bath, getting out of the bath, and I couldn't stand on it. And I thought, well, I'll leave it a month, and I'll start training again, and I'll be back on it for the next half marathon. Ran on it again, and it just went again. And I had to have a good 3-4 months out, missed the half marathon. And that was the first time in my life where sort of age had caught up with me a little bit, and I couldn't just run off an injury. And now at 44, I'm pretty lucky because I have kept myself in good shape.
But you need to sustain an injury from time to time and learn to bounce back from it. It's the same concept of being beaten. You need to be beaten on occasion. You need to lose sometimes to learn how to pick yourself back up and continue, because you see so many athletes, even in the professional field, a lot of them are genetically gifted and they've never had injuries, but then they get to this critical point where they sustain an injury and it's almost like they're suicidal. They don't know what to do with their lives because they've been so invested in competing and winning, and they've never had to deal with that level of defeat before. So it is important to learn how to be defeated, to learn how to fail, so you can teach yourself to persevere regardless of the setbacks, to get back on the horse. You know, so I think that's the beauty of injuries. They test you mentally just as much as a 10K run will, you know.
Look, I agree, and I don't really have much, because most of the things that I do are sort of solo events, sort of runs, bike riding or lifting, where you're not really getting defeated. You're more or less testing yourself to what you can push yourself through. But I do play games competitively. And I'll tell you what, you are right. If you go on some mad winning streak of like 30 wins in a row, you start getting really sloppy and not picking things up. But when you actually take a beating from somebody who's better than you, and you look back and you review the footage, the way they move, the tactics they use, you learn so much more from those losses than you do just from winning every other game. And when you're up against people who are actually good and you beat them, after learning from them and understanding sort of high-level tactics and honing your skills, the feeling is a lot better than just running away with it all the time. So I do agree. I've never done that in sport because I don't play sort of team or competitive sports. But when I do things where I'm competing against people, I do always want to win. But I do acknowledge that you tend to learn more from your defeats than you do from just winning. And if you're
willing, it transfers over into politics as well, doesn't it, Mark? Because we're up against a sophisticated opponent politically, and there's plenty to learn from the, as you say, high-level tactics, sophisticated, developed attacks. And we have to continue to adapt to the situation, to the environment, and we have to learn how to get better, how to get smarter, if we're going to start producing victories for our community.
Do you know, it's interesting you say that, because when I was in the BNP, I always cite one of the great failings of the BNP was that every time we lost, every time we won, we wrote it up as we are the best, we smashed it, we're brilliant, we're on top of our game. But every time we lost, it was because the media pulled some stunt, UKIP ended up standing against us, which depleted our vote. There was some kind of smear. Labour had some dirty tactics. Hope Not Hate went out and put out leaflets against us, which destroyed our vote. And every time we lost, we blamed these external factors. So we rarely ever sat round a table and said, look, you know, we got 20% here.
So you never said our campaign wasn't good enough.
Yeah,
we need to adapt. It was always someone else's fault. Let's just keep doing what we've always done and try to win again. Yeah,
yeah. Whenever you won, it was because of the genius of our campaign team. But whenever you lost, it was because of, it was basically you were cheated out of it. So people got into this mindset that an analysis of an election was never a genuine, you never said, well, setting these things aside, where did we let ourselves down? And I think that ability to look at what you're doing and to say, look, there's a hole there in what we do. And we do that now with Patriotic Alternative. Even after a conference like the one we had, and you've been very kind about it, I've actually not had any negative feedback about it, which is odd because usually I get at least one piece of negative feedback. But the interesting thing is this. When we sit down and discuss these things, I say to people, this is how I think the conference went. And then I say to people, right, how do you think it went? But most importantly, what do you think went wrong and what can we improve on? Because there's no point everyone just sitting there going, wow, the buffet lunch was the best we've ever had. You know, it's got to be like, well, you know what went slightly wrong? At the redirection point, there was two car parks at the train station. And in future, you need to designate which car parks the redirection, the north or the south, because not every train station has just one car. Ah, yeah, some people got lost in the south car park because we're in the north. Things like that are what you want to hear to improve it. And I think nationalists are so quick to say we lost because of all these external factors. It has hampered growth in the past. I don't know whether you guys experienced that in Australia, because at the moment you guys are getting lots of publicity. I watch you and Joel quite a lot of mornings, because you end up, you're streaming your evening show when I'm sort of up in the morning answering emails and doing stuff like that. So it's actually quite good, because I watch you guys and hear what you're up to. But how do you guys stay on top of things, and how are you dealing with all the publicity you're getting at the moment with Jacob and, you know, Tom and all the other mad stuff that seems to be going on down there?
Well, I'm not a direct member of any group down here at the moment. I'm just out here on my own. And I don't have all of the facts regarding what the boys have been experiencing over the past few weeks. But I can say that Jacob and Thomas Sewell, Joel, these guys have been pretty aggressive in their protest activity over the past month or so. And I believe that's it's a result of Joel's energy. Joel Davis, I'm speaking about, the guy is very consistent, very committed, high energy, aggressive. He doesn't mind creating controversy. He isn't scared of sharing his opinion and sharing it as loudly as possible. And ever since Joel's became involved in Melbourne's right-wing protest culture, you might say, it's been taken up a couple of notches, especially in its frequency. Like, these guys haven't really protested as frequently as they have lately. And I think the aim may have been to normalize their protest activity, their sort of message, because that's what the radical left have done in Melbourne. Their message was quite radical, very extreme, but they protested so frequently that gradually their protests became a normal thing. The police came used to it, the culture adapted to it. And by protesting so frequently, none of these guys have said this to me, but I'm of the opinion that they're trying to normalize their message, which is a more racist right-wing message, to normalize a level of racism to make it acceptable for Australians to become somewhat racist again for the purposes of protecting white Australia and the original nation state, I think. But they've had some police attention lately. Specifically, it seems the police are specifically interested in Thomas Sewell. They've taken a disliking to him and they've charged him with intimidating a police officer. And I don't know all the facts, but I have heard that the police officer had to change his address. Don't hold me to that. I'm not sure. I don't think he had to. If that is the case, it seems like it's part of a process and it wasn't really warranted. It was an overreaction. Things aren't as serious as they seem when you hear the charge. I didn't even know that was a charge down here, intimidating a police officer. I didn't know that was in legislation, but apparently it's taken pretty seriously by the cops and by the courts. There's been indications by Victoria Police, State Police down here, that they're going to be issuing more charges in relation to some of the protest activity and the stunts that these guys have been pulling over the past month or two. It hasn't happened yet, but the ball is rolling on that, I think. Usually when Victoria Police say they're intending to charge you, it's to get a reaction from you to try to get more evidence to back up those charges. And those charges generally do come in the mail within 6 to 12 months. So the guys will have their hands full with that. And I suppose I'll be streaming with Joel tonight and possibly with Tom. Hopefully he jumps on too, because I've been waiting to get Tom's take on the raids he experienced a couple of weeks ago. He was raided twice, I think twice in a period of 48 hours. And both of those raids were in relation to the same investigation, intimidating a police officer. I haven't had his take on it yet. We'll be getting that tonight on the Joel and Blair show, hopefully, if he jumps on. And then we'll have more facts and understand a little bit more about the situation. I think we have heard a little bit. Tom has probably shared a little bit of the story, but as things sit right now, there's a few more developments that I haven't heard about yet. But the boys have still been active. I think they attended a public forum yesterday. It was a forum, I think, hosted perhaps by the Liberal Party, which is one of the major parties in Australia. They're jumping on this issue out in a suburb called Berwick, where an iconic lake has been renamed to something Indian. I think it was the founder of the Sikh religion, because Sikhs, Indian Sikhs who have immigrated into the area, have been lobbying the government to change the name of this lake for some reason, to better reflect, I think, their presence in the area and the marvelous contributions that the Indian Sikhs have made to the Australian nation, blah, blah, blah. That's what the government officials say anyway. And this has attracted a lot of attention from people in politics from all sides. So that's something the boys have been busy with lately. But yeah, look, long story short, the guys have been really active down here, the guys in Nationalist Activism Australia, and they're copping a lot of heat from the police as a result. But we'll know more in the next few weeks whether or not guys are going to continue to get charged, what the charges will be. It's going to be one of those long legal battles for a few of them, I think.
Well, we'll look forward to future updates on that. And obviously wish you guys all the best with what you do down there. And I am sure that you'll continue to fly the flag. Now, let's move on to some of the news issues. The big news issue is obviously Trump got elected, and more or less immediately, there's been good and bad with Trump's election. There's been a lot of very poor appointments, and I'm not going to go through all of those with you tonight. But one of the good things he said was, let's end this nonsense in the Ukraine. Let's end this madness. Let's find a way to negotiate peace in the borderlands of the Ukraine, come to a settlement with Russia and stop wasting money over there. And that's a really good thing, because here in the UK, I think we've just wasted another $3 billion on the Ukraine, yet we are having a massive land grab to take farmers' land to pay for stuff like that. We've cut winter fuel allowance for overwhelmingly white pensioners, about 10 million of them. But all that money is going to the Ukraine, $3.3 billion. So everyone was like, great, you know, if this thing comes to an end, that will mean less of our money going over there. It will mean less bloodshed. And it'll mean an end to another sort of, what can we say? We'll call it a NATO war, because they were the ones that stoked it. But with Trump saying that, the current administration, the Biden administration, and there's still 2 months before Trump comes in. I think he comes in on January the 20th is when he's officially sworn in. So they've still got 2 months with Biden as president. And because of that, Biden has now gone, and I don't believe it's Biden. I don't believe he made this decision. I think it's obviously the people are pulling his strings. But they have now gone pedal to the metal and said that US missiles can now be launched, not just on Russian targets in the Ukraine, but on Russian targets within Russia, including infrastructure, which obviously affects civilians. That's effectively a civilian target once you start going for infrastructure. Now, this seems to be taking us ever closer to World War III, because in the past, there's been numerous proxy wars. So when America went into Vietnam, the Soviet Union supplied the Vietnamese with weapons. When the Soviet Union went into Afghanistan, America supplied weapons to the Afghan resistance. But never before have American weapons been used on Russian soil, and never have Russian weapons been used on American soil. And this really ratchets things up to a new level. And obviously, Russia is a very well-armed nuclear country. What do you think of this, Blair? And how do you see this going forward? Is this just indicative of the mindset of the people who are in control? You know, they've just been thrashed in an election. One of the reasons people voted against them, because they don't want a continuation of this conflict. But in their last 2 months, rather than acknowledging the desires of the people, they're going to push things as far as they can and potentially trigger a global war.
I think foreign nations and their leaders will understand that that's what the Biden administration is trying to do on its way out. And so they're unlikely to react to it in the way that administration is wanting them to. So I wouldn't worry about any world wars being sparked in the next couple of months before Trump officially becomes the president again. But there, you would think there would be some sort of checks and balances in place to ensure that a government or, you know, what do you call it, like a presidency, cabinet, before leaving office can't wreck and sabotage that office before the next president comes in. And I'm sure those kinds of processes exist. So I wouldn't be too alarmed about it. I don't know, though, because I haven't seen all the facts about what they're actually doing. I suppose time will tell.
Well, let's hope. Let's hope we don't end up going into Christmas and seeing the conflict explode in a way it hasn't previously done, because the last thing we need now is some kind of escalation of this conflict. Now, there's something I want to play you here, Blair, and I just want your opinion on this, because I found this quite interesting. I don't know if you've seen it, but I'm going to play you a video file. So this is an advert for a company. Now, I don't know if you've seen this, but I'd like people in the chat to guess what company it's for before it comes up at the end of the advert. Now that was go for it, mate. Go for
it. Jaguar? Isn't Jaguar like the typical car owned by a racist old white boomer?
Well, yes, Jaguar was a luxury car manufacturer, and here we are. I mean, are they even trying to sell cars? That's the first question.
This stuff is just going to make being an ordinary, upstanding, healthy white person popular again. Pushing this kind of be difference, break standards, you know, pink hair, weird clothing and whatever else, you know, this kind of culture, it's becoming so cringe, so played out that the new counterculture is to just actually be normal. You know what I mean? Like to be a normal heterosexual white person with a job, who isn't trying to stand out as some sort of weird alternative freak, that's going to become cool as a result of these people becoming so, you know, mainstream, obsessed with forcing their bullshit into the public sphere. I mean, it is, in my opinion, already at that point where it's more respectable now. It's cooler to actually just be healthy, normal, upstanding citizen, you know. And so, you know, it's kind of exhausting, isn't it, Mark? Because you see this stuff all the time now. I mean, I walked past recently a Bonds store. Bonds is a brand of underwear, like in Australia. Like you can go in there and buy underwear for men, underwear for women. And in the window is this huge poster of a fat black guy wearing jocks, like really fat. And I later discovered they've actually, Bonds in Australia, have flown this guy from America to take photos of him for their Bonds Australia stores. And he's masquerading as a model, you know. And it's actually repulsive to look at it. It's like, it makes me not want to buy that underwear ever again. And I'm sure a lot of people feel the same way. It's like beauty is not subjective. Like you can't just be fat, hairy, and disgusting and believe that that's a kind of standard that's appropriate to display publicly in order to try to sell a product. You think you're pushing boundaries, but really you're just sabotaging your own business. I think it's going to take a little bit more time, but plenty of businesses are going to realize that's true.
I think they will. But the thing that shocked me about Jaguar is the people that they are trying to appeal to with that sort of marketing campaign would never, ever buy a Jaguar. Never. They're people.
The only people who drive. Some people drive Jags in Australia. They have to order them over from England, but some people do. It's always angry, middle class, slightly racist, white boomers. Always. They're the only people who drive Jags. So what the hell are Jaguar doing, you know?
Well, they're trying to destroy their marketplace. But I think this is where somebody in the hierarchy says, right, we need to reach out to a new audience. Let's hire these forward-thinking marketing executives and let's see what they come up with. And that's what they came up with. And it was complete and utter shite. But if it hadn't have said Jaguar at the end, and this is a genuine question, if it hadn't said Jaguar at the end, would you have had a clue? What would you have thought that was for? Because if it hadn't said Jaguar at the end and said, what do you think that's for? I would have thought, because of the bright colours, quite garish and bright, I'd have thought maybe it was a makeup advert. You know, something for, say, like, you know, when you see sort of young girls, they don't use muted colours, but they use these sort of explosive makeup colours. I thought it would be something like that. But to actually, to think that was for a car, do you think without the name coming up at the end, you'd have guessed?
It surprised me. I thought a modern art festival, a certain brand of clothing or jewelry that they wanted trendy young people to go for. I don't know. But for a car, like I said, for a car that stereotypically is only bought by one sort of person, it was weird, man. It was weird. But it's just something that we've seen all too often, as I said, and it's going to, I think this kind of thing will just push people to, you know, back into a more normal and respectable presentation of themselves. Hopefully, anyway. Hopefully, normal becomes the counterculture. I can see that happening already, though, in the youth to some degree. Youth in Australia seem to be taking an interest in and even idolizing earlier times, like clothing styles from the 80s and 90s, even music from these times. It's like even the youth are becoming so sick to death of modern culture, and they're looking back at times before they were born, and they're liking what they see in earlier times, and they're trying to emulate and bring some of that back. So that's a good sign, I think.
I agree. And I think we are seeing an increasing number of people sort of rebelling against all of that in every aspect of their lives. And eventually, I think it will become cool to not be like that. And it is interesting to see that largely that kind of mentality is what lost Kamala Harris the election. Because obviously, white Americans only make up about 61% of the population. So it wasn't just a white victory. A huge amount of actually Catholic, traditionalist Hispanics living in America voted against all that stuff and voted for Trump. And I do think that it's quite interesting that even sort of the non-white population, and I'm not saying that they're going to be our buddies or ride to our rescue before anyone says anything, but it is interesting that even the non-white population despises this kind of woke, transgender, weird, asexual agenda that they've got. You know, and in the wake of this, you've seen some of these Democrats actually start removing their pronouns from their biographies on Twitter and other social media platforms, because this stuff is getting played out and people just don't want it.
What Kamala Harris had to do to win was actually distance herself from what the Democrat Party has become. She had to basically insinuate that woke culture had gone too far and that representing loud minorities, that had been played out, and representing the ordinary American and listening to what the American actually wants, whether it's mass deportations, whatever it is, that was what Kamala Harris had to do to win, distance herself from this kind of like marvelous charade that the Democrat Party has turned into. But she didn't manage to do that. And as a result, people voted for Donald Trump, the Republicans, because they told the people that they were going to give the people what they want. And what the people want seems to be mass deportations. I mean, Donald Trump just verified a rumor that he's planning to use military assets to deport 20 million illegals. And they're going to be looking for those people, rounding them up, and taking them home. That's going to be happening in the next 6 to 12 months, and the army's going to be involved. And that's what the Americans want. It seems to be what they voted for. That's what they're waiting for. And I don't think Kamala Harris was strong enough to acknowledge that. She was too worried about what leftist advisors were going to say. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because in some Trump speeches, you can see that he's amused by the fact that his own advisors, and he says this in his speeches, his own advisors tell him not to bring up certain subjects. For example, they tell him not to say that there's only two genders. But then he says it and he gets the most applause that he got out of any other comment that he made that night, you know. So he laughs at the fact that, as he puts it, these political geniuses, they don't seem to be able to read the crowd as well as he can during his some of his speeches. But it's exciting times because there's an entire shift happening right now in culture where the woke culture, or just the radical left perspective of life, and the idea of turning everything upside down, and where right is wrong and wrong is right, and the lines between right and wrong are always blurred. This has reached its pinnacle. It's not going to go any further. It's on its way down. It's on its way out. Everybody senses it. Even the mainstream media seems to be adjusting itself to that reality. Elon Musk has bought Twitter and essentially turned it into 4chan, where free speech is mostly possible again. Obviously, you're still not allowed on there, and certain people are still kicked off there for various reasons, but it's much freer than it used to be. The kind of things people are talking about on Twitter, I can't even believe they're getting away with it. 3 or 4 years ago, it would have been impossible. I saw a graph where it said that something like 40, I don't know, more Democrats used to use Twitter for news just 2 years ago. And now there's an equal playing field, where just as many people who voted Democrat are using Twitter now as did the Republican voters. And I think that reflects the fact that Twitter is just censoring far fewer people now and allowing more conversation. And it's funny, isn't it? Because the minute censorship is wound back, then our perspectives, our talking points become extremely popular. So in order to keep down nationalism, in order to keep down right-wing point of view, censorship is absolutely necessary. In order for the left to maintain relevance and any threshold of power, they need censorship. They need extreme censorship. Without that censorship, we win.
Yeah, I agree. And that's a very good point. If you don't have any censorship, fundamentally, our talking points just bulldoze everything. It's like early YouTube. So YouTube was absolutely fantastic because YouTube, when it was a marketplace of free ideas, it was absolutely fantastic for us. And the content creators producing nationalist content were flying high. And those on the left, you know, just couldn't keep up with the content we were making. And the only way they could is when YouTube themselves had to step in and tilt it in their direction by essentially banning us and boosting them. And it does go to show that in the marketplace of ideas, when things are placed on a level playing field, we win every single time. Unfortunately, though, the problem that we face is that at the moment, things still aren't a level playing field. And unfortunately, one of my big issues with what's going on at the moment is you've got this issue with sort of Twitter and other social media outlets, which are sort of softening to kind of the MAGA talking points, but still quite aggressively banning people who are openly racial nationalists or willing to talk about issues pertaining to Zionism or Israel. So recently on Twitter, you've seen sort of several bans of a big name sort of white nationalist accounts. And that's in the wake of the Trump victory or around the date of the election, which is obviously disappointing. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, look at what happened to the last platform that took censorship very seriously and aggressively censored anyone. Various governments around the world lobbied that platform to censor, which was Facebook. It's turned into a graveyard. Hardly anyone uses Facebook anymore. And I think there's a big lesson in there for the people who own and host these social media companies. I mean, if Meta or Zuckerberg didn't buy Instagram when he did, he would have been shot by now. Like, Facebook is just boring. No one's on there. It's not generating nearly as much interest or revenue as it used to. And that's because it censored everybody that every government around the world told it to censor. So I think what some of these social media companies need to understand is governments around the world have their agendas, and they're filled with hysterical people who have the wrong idea about what people are saying and why. And I think governments target people that don't really need to be targeted. And like I said, they overreact. So if you're going to, as a social media company, if you're going to obey every single government directive around the world, your company's not going to last very long, because you're just going to end up shutting down anyone who's interesting. And as a result, you're going to be left with not very much excitement on your platform. But I haven't really used X that much. I started a new account, a while ago, but I don't post to it very much. I try to get into it again, but the message, you have to understand this, Mark, the message on X right now is so radical. When I was on Twitter, back when I was allowed on it in 2016, I was effective because I was able to make posts and use language that was insinuating a level of nationalism or a nationalist message, but it wasn't so explicit. But now X is extremely explicit, where people are discussing Jewish power, people are discussing Second World War from a revisionist point of view. They're discussing Hitler's philosophy and why Hitler was right. And they're discussing all of that very openly. And there's also stuff that's just vehemently racist. And I'm just struggling to find where I fit into this equation. So I don't post very much. I'm mostly just observing and paying attention to the shift in culture. But X is still only one aspect of culture. It's not everything. But I do believe it can be close to the center. It could be close to the center in the future, especially because Elon Musk and Donald Trump seem to be good friends, or at least, you know, they're friendly with each other, ostensibly. And I think, I don't know, I'm just trying to ride this cultural wave as best I can and see where it takes us. I think there's a great opportunity for us, though, in our current climate to make a big comeback and spread our message far and wide.
Now, one thing I wanted to bring up with you, and this is something specifically, this is for you, and it's not directly political, but it goes back to things we were talking about earlier with fitness. Now, at the moment, there's been this big buzz in the media about this jab that people are having called Ozempic to help them lose weight. Have you heard of that?
Yeah. Was it a tablet or an injectable?
I'm not sure, actually. I thought it was injectable, but it might have been a tablet. But either way, they were taking Ozempic, and Ozempic was it's essentially meant to be a weight loss treatment. It's meant to make you lose weight. Now, I didn't know this. I didn't know how it worked or the science behind it. I was totally in the dark. And the other day, I get really random stuff recommended to me on YouTube, really random stuff. And one of the things I got recommended was how Ozempic works. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. So I started to watch it. Now, I don't know if you know, but when you take this drug, it works by preventing you from digesting the food in your gut. So that if you eat, you can eat basically as much as you want, but you simply won't digest it. It just passes through you undigested. You chew it up, goes into your gut, comes out the other end, and you basically don't take the nutrients from it. So essentially your body goes into sort of an extreme starvation mode where it not only burns fat, but it actually does destroy muscle, bone density, and other things as well. So it's actually quite dangerous. And I was thinking to myself, can you imagine putting yourself through all that just to lose a little bit of weight rather than, you know, moderating what you eat and, you know, maybe doing a little bit of light exercise, going for a walk every day, you know, getting a pet dog and taking it out twice a day. But don't you find it incredibly sad that people today are that desperate for a quick fix to something which is pretty easily fixable when you think about it, that they would actually do something as stupid as take some poorly tested drug, which could potentially, you know, alter your bone structure, destroy muscle mass, and fundamentally doesn't even deal with the root cause of your of the issue, because you still eat just as much as you would. And when you come off the drug, what do you do then? Do you stop eating all of a sudden? Because obviously, if as soon as you come off it, if you're still eating at that pace, will you put all the weight straight back on again?
The human body is not hackable. You can't throw something out of balance and expect it to expect not to suffer consequences, obviously. And that's the problem with these magic solution pills or drugs. I've had a lot of personal experience. Like when you say, I can't believe someone would put an experimental drug into themselves to see what would happen. Well, I'm guilty of doing that more than once. But I seem to have the constitution to deal with it. However, by experimenting with different performance-enhancing drugs, I did discover that the body is not hackable. The body has or prefers to be in a certain state of balance that it establishes itself. And when you take these drugs, the body does start to resist them. And a drug that prevents food from digesting, I haven't read up on Ozempic. I've heard about it, but I haven't done any research into it. So I can't really make any learned comment. But I can say that that sounds dangerous to me. You need to digest food efficiently in order to feed, repair your muscles. To repair and keep your brain healthy as well, it requires nutrients, which it absorbs through digestion. So if Ozempic is actually preventing digestion, that's not a good thing. I think if you want to lose weight, you should just stop eating so much. And it's really not that difficult if you just avoid sugars, count your calories. And if you're sitting there feeling hungry, you just get up and move around. You ride an exercise bike, you go for a walk, you keep yourself busy. Keeping yourself busy is one of the easiest ways to prevent yourself from binge eating. When you're sitting around not doing anything in a house that's full of snacks, colorful, tasty snacks, well, of course you're going to keep eating. So having an ambition, having a goal and focusing on it, keeping yourself busy in pursuit of achieving something that's important to you, making something, creating something, drawing something, reading something, whatever it is that's got your interests, right? Whatever it is that pertains to your interests specifically. Keep yourself busy and just don't eat so much. It's really easy, actually, in my opinion. Well, you know, for everybody, it's not so easy. But that's all I have to say about the Ozempic question, I suppose. I did hear celebrities were using it, though, and of course it's going to produce results. But I worry about the long-term effects something preventing digestion could have, because having a healthy muscular structure is essential to feeling good. And if your muscles, if you're in a catabolic state for too long, which means if your body is using muscle tissue for energy, you don't feel very good about that. And you're not going to be on top of your game. You need to sustain a good, healthy amount of muscle mass in order to enjoy the highest quality of life. And anything that's going to prevent your muscles from repairing themselves, sustaining themselves, which is going to be anything that interrupts with efficient digestion, yeah, can't recommend it.
The thing that annoys me with people today is it's just the short-termism. It's this idea of wanting everything. So whatever you do in life, there's got to be some sort of compromise or some sacrifice. You know, you're not going to be a great athlete unless you put time and effort in. You know, you're not going to be a great scholar unless you put time and effort in. You're not going to have a great body if you, you know, eat junk and refuse to exercise. But it's this mentality that people want something for nothing and they want it immediately. And I think that mindset which is driving the production of this kind of drug, I think is the worrying thing. Now, you might sort of say, well, you've taken certain, you know, performance enhancing drugs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, you've injected yourself with things which are experimental. But the thing is, I think what a lot of people miss with that aspect of fitness or bodybuilding, and a lot of people say this, they go, oh, you know, they go to the gym and they see a big guy and they go, oh, look, he's on the juice. It doesn't count. It doesn't count. I've turned around to guys before at the gym and said, look, it doesn't matter whether he's on the juice or not. To get that big, to get that definition, to look that good, he still had to put the work in. You know, the issue of performance enhancing drugs, you don't just inject them and the next day you wake up and you're built like Arnold Schwarzenegger at his prime, you still have to go to the gym. You still have to eat right. You still have to structure your day. There's a lot of effort that goes in. And if you hadn't taken the PEDs, you'd still look good, but you just wouldn't look as good. Now, the thing with Ozempic is it's kind of the opposite of that. There is no effort that goes in. There's no compromise. There's no will. It's just they want to sit on the couch, living like they've always lived, but look great at the same time. And that's what always boggles my mind. The idea that people have got this sort of short-termist solution and think that they should be able to get where they want in life without any effort, any compromise, and basically without having to give anything to get the desired result. And I as a person, I've just never understood that.
From my point of view, I felt that my body would not respond the way I wanted it to high intensity training. I feel that genetically, as a race, we've been bastardized. I don't think we should have to put the amount of effort we do have to put into physical exercise in order to look a certain way. I think the way we were created, because I theorize that we were created, that we did not evolve as a result of random molecular circumstance. I feel like it's disappointing that we're at a level of degradation where in order to just maintain a healthy muscular structure, we have to dedicate 1 to 2 hours a day of intense weightlifting. Well, that's what I had to do anyway. And so I think that's what led me personally to experimenting with performance enhancing drugs, because I wanted to, well, I'm disappointed that I felt that I had to do that. But really the reason I felt I had to do it in the past was because I wanted to achieve a certain level of strength, performance, aesthetics that I felt should just be the basic standard for men. Like, I feel that I'm not even really up to standard as a result of all my training still. Like, so why is that? I think it comes down to just bad breeding for too long. Possibly we used to live a lot longer than we do, and we used to maintain a lot more muscle mass without having to put the amount of work that we put into doing to maintaining it now. And so I think that's why maybe some of our minds, you know, some guys go to drugs, performance enhancers, because it's just not like feasible either for the average person who works all day and sits in traffic for, you know, 3 to 4 hours, is on public transport for a long time. It's not always realistic for somebody to fit into their living or regular working schedule the necessary amount of training time to look like a Greek god in addition to doing all of that work as well. So that's why people look for shortcuts. And look, performance enhancing drugs are always going to exist. As long as I've been alive, there's been some new magic pill or product that's been advertised to people that doesn't always turn out to be what it's cracked up to be. And I think Ozempic will probably just fit into that category as well. There'll be a bit of hype about it for a while, then it will be found to cause some sort of, you know, pancreatic condition, because it's probably going to screw with your blood sugar. If it's going to screw with your digestion, there's going to be a problem with insulin. And I know that if you keep insulin down for, I actually won't get into that. That's a little bit too technical. I'll just leave it at that.
I like it when you get technical, but yeah, let's leave it as that. Let's do some super chats. We're going into the second hour of the show. If you haven't super chatted yet, but you would like to super chat, please do, you know, consider making a donation. We've got another hour of the show. This is where we read the super chats. So here goes. Let's get started. And we'll start with Jagdeep Jaino, who gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, following on from Mark and Joel's review of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I'd like to recommend the documentary Hollywoodism, an Empire of Their Own. It explains how Hollywood was entirely Jewish since its inception and how the Jewish moguls used their movies to subvert American society from day one. Well, that's certainly something I would be interested in viewing. I don't know. Have you seen that? Have you seen that documentary, Blair?
What was the documentary called?
An empire of their own. It's about Jewish control over Hollywood.
No, but just yesterday I found myself glued to my phone because I found what I suppose you could describe as a documentary on X. But rather than a typical documentary, it was more of a review. A review of incidents that have occurred over the past couple of thousand years involving child sacrifice or human sacrifice. And these sacrificial rituals are apparently or allegedly performed by Jews and Jewish families, usually in relation to their holiday Passover. Now, it's not usually something that I would just go out there and watch and fall into. And obviously, you have to be careful with what you accuse people of on a live stream these days. But it's not any accusation I'm making. It's just what this particular video review suggested. And it's pretty alarming stuff. What's most alarming about it isn't just the details of how all the blood is extracted from these victims for the purposes of power, longevity, some weird religious ritual, but how much data and documentation has actually been and what's been written down by significant persons, monarchs, popes, in relation to some of these accusations. There's been hundreds of Jews throughout the history of Europe burned alive in consequence for some of these child sacrifices they were found to be involved in. And apparently it still happens now too. And it's all very hushed up. But that was interesting enough to maintain my attention for over an hour. I can't actually tell you what the name of it was because I came across it randomly. It was in a response or a reply to some post somebody else made, and I found myself just watching it out of interest. But I don't know if it's true or not, but I will tell you, as I already said, it's alarming the amounts of stuff that's been written down about some of these, you know, human sacrifices that have taken place throughout the past. Creepy stuff. And it does make you wonder, well, it got me thinking, because, you know, the Jewish people ostensibly are a very unimpressive people. It's like, what is it about the Jewish people that gives them so much power and influence in the world? Money lending? Money lending isn't that impressive. Anyone can lend money and, you know, request interest upon return of payment. So it's like, is there something else we don't understand that contributes to the Jewish influence in the world, that contributes to their power? Is there some other realm that influences this one? And, you know, maybe sacrificing innocent people can actually get you power or something. I don't know. But that's what that particular documentary got me thinking about.
You'll have to send me that because I'd be very interested in watching that. I've never watched anything like that, but it's something that I would absolutely like to delve into. So please send that. DSell and 7 gave $15. Thank you so much. He said, I believe Trump will likely scale back American support for the regime in Ukraine and possibly put a stop to the conflict. But I shudder to think of the conflict he will foment with Iran, Lebanon, Syria, and all of Israel's enemies. Next to these, Ukraine is entirely expendable to the regime. Yeah, potentially we are going to see, you know, a serious issue with the Middle East. Trump has appointed a lot of people who, unfortunately, are very, very pro-Zionist and very pro-Israel. And some of those people are working domestically to silence people in America who they accuse of anti-Semitism. And some of those people will no doubt be working internationally to aid Israel in their ethnic cleansing in the Middle East. I don't know if you've got anything to say about that, Blair.
What, ethnic cleansing in the Middle East? Sorry, I was just distracted by something. What was the question?
It was just that the Ukraine conflict might come to an end, but Trump is likely to ramp things up in the Middle East.
That was my concern as well, that there's a bit of a plan to just send more American soldiers into a war that doesn't really benefit or, you know, it's not really relevant to America or the interests, American interests at all. I hope that doesn't happen, but time will tell. I think in the immediate future, Trump is going to appease the Americans and the voters quite a bit. He's probably going to engage in some deportations and some stricter laws surrounding illegal immigration. And that's going to have people supportive of Trump, all in up in arms about Trump. And possibly it could just be an effort to soften up the American population to prepare them for war in the Middle East. So soldiers will feel probably more loyal to Trump and to Trump's America as a result of Trump's good work in the beginning of his presidency. That's what my gut tells me, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, let's see what happens. I mean, there's good and bad with this, but I'm not as negative about it as certain Americans are, but that's maybe because I don't live in America. It Was Made Up gave $10 and says, yes, but can you do the Jared Taylor press-ups? Well, Jared Taylor's on the show next week, so maybe you can ask him. I don't know what a Jared Taylor press-up is. However, I'm always interested.
Have you seen the video? It's like when he's stretched right out, so your arms are straight in front of you, your legs are straight, and I think you're pressing up, but rather than your hands being flat, you're actually pressing up through your fingertips with straight arms. And you have to somehow like press yourself up like that. There's a video of it that someone made a meme out of. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, I certainly haven't been doing the Jared Taylor press-ups. One thing I have done, though, to keep my sort of my body in reasonable working order is vary the width that I put my arms when I'm doing the push-ups. Because if you do them exactly the same every time, it wears a lot more than if you sort of vary it slightly. Dare Truska gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, good discussion on health and fitness. And Mark, congratulations on the over 9,000 push-up challenge. Well, thank you so much. Glenn19 gave $2. Thank you so much. He said, Mark, you can learn from British history about Britain learning from their losses and coming back to win. The first Anglo-Afghan War, the first Anglo-Maratha War, and the first Anglo-Mysore were losses for the British military, but they won on the second ones. I didn't know that. I'd have to look into that.
When the English went into the Nepalese mountains, they came across the Gurkhas, which were like a Nepalese fighting force who were brutal. They have this curved blade. I can't remember what it's called, but they killed a lot of the English, and the English really admired them for it. They're like, wow, these guys are savages. And, you know, they ended up beating them and recruiting them. And now, out of respect for them being such great opponents, there's statues like of the Gurkha soldiers throughout London. I found a few of them and looked into the history. The English coming across an adversary, which was so brutal. I'm not sure if I just cut out then. It was a bit of a freeze, but I'll say it again. It's an example of the British coming across an adversary that was so brutal enough to seriously challenge them, that they admire them for it. Like, it's like when you come across an opponent that's actually good enough to beat you, the best thing to do is not to blame external factors for why you couldn't win and fail to take responsibility, but you should admire your opponent, learn what you can from the opponent that has clearly demonstrated that they've got the capacity to defeat you, and do what you can to overcome that, make yourself better, right?
Yeah, I think war is obviously a grim thing, and I don't want to sit here and glorify war. But for Europeans, war has always been something that has been a driver of technology and advancement. And you've always found, especially when Europeans have fought each other, that that has been a time of unbelievable technological advancement for European people. A lot of the things we take for granted today were actually offshoots of military technology, which was developed for the purpose of war. So, as I say, I'm not glorifying war, but I think Europeans have a habit of going to war and using those periods as times of great technological advancement, which go on to shape the future, not just in the outcome of the war, but in the outcome of what we've achieved. I mean, if you look at rocketry, all rocketry comes from the Second World War, from a small group of German scientists who at the end of the war were fought over by both the Soviets and the Americans. I mean, both the Soviets and the Americans fought extremely hard to capture German scientists. And the space race was largely conducted by two different sets of scientists.
It's a shame, though. It's a shame how much of our warrior stock is eliminated through these wars. A lot of these guys were these soldiers. They were of great stock, but they never had children, and they died young in these European wars. And we lost a lot of good blood in those wars. I think that's one of the downsides. You are right, though. But I believe we're always in a state of warfare. I think it's wrong to think that warfare, the concept of warfare, should only be understood as being violent or, you know, outright overt warfare. We're always in a state of war, and our enemies always exist, and they're always hostile. That warfare and hostility just expresses itself in certain ways. And when violent warfare is postponed, it's always done so at the disadvantage of one side. And our side, which you might describe as like white people of the world, is currently the side that's at the disadvantage during our current postponement of violent war.
I think when it comes to the First and Second World War, I don't believe that any wars throughout history have done as much to destroy and deplete the best of European stock of those two wars. And if you do, you know, if you obviously look back on those wars and you look at what we've lost, I've got to say, it's heartbreaking. And you often see images, or I often see images when I'm sort of reading about these wars, especially of sort of like dead Germans on the Eastern Front, and you look at the quality of the men that lost their lives, you know, marching off to the East to fight, and they never came home. They never, ever bred because of this. And those men were absolute models of what a European man should look like. And you look at the dysgenic mess that we've got now. I mean, if you go around certain British towns or cities, and you have, and I always attribute this to two things. I don't know what you think about this, but I always attribute this to two things. I see, on one hand, I think our genetic stock has declined due to those two wars. And on the other hand, you look at the poison that people now ingest. So you tend to have sort of two overriding instances of people who have poisoned themselves. The first are the overweight, the ones who sort of eat a lot, drink all the fizzy pops, and live a very sedentary lifestyle. You see a lot of those in British towns and cities, you know, big, fat, you know, incredibly overweight people. But then on the other hand, you see these incredibly skinny guys, you know, all broken, rotted teeth, and they've got some kind of addiction. Now, whether that addiction is alcohol or whether it's something worse, you know, heroin, you know, or another drug. You know, people say weed isn't addictive. I know people have been heavily addicted to weed, and it's had a massive effect on their mental and physical well-being. And that problem's only going to get worse with time. Now you've got, you know, packs of kids walking around from the age of 12 smoking it, you know, every you know, free moment they've got. But I do think we're going to see over the next few years that sort of combination of reduced you know, genetic goodness, if you like, mixed with addiction, and the outcome is just horrific. I don't know if you saw any of that when you were in the UK, or if you have the same thing where you know, in America.
In London, especially in Kennington, because that's where we stayed first couple of nights, in Kennington, I noticed a lot of Africans, more Africans in and around London than I've ever seen anywhere in my life, smoking weed in public. I continuously smelt marijuana everywhere I went. I couldn't believe it, because there were police everywhere, but the police wouldn't do anything about it. I suppose because it's so common, there's not really a lot they can do. And maybe they don't mind the black immigrants smoking marijuana because it probably placates them and makes them less likely to commit crimes. So maybe it is some sort of initiative from the government to get them smoking chuff to keep them passive. I don't know. All I know is I was walking through London and I smelled marijuana everywhere. I don't like marijuana either. It kind of sets off alarm bells in my brain, the smell of it, because I had a bad experience with it once. But yeah, that was what I can say about England. I didn't notice any young white kids smoking it because I didn't really see many young white kids in London. But yeah, the Africans certainly appreciate it.
you smell it everywhere around here. So whether you're in white areas or whether you're in ethnic areas, people walk around, they're always, always smoking it. I think it's highly addictive. I've known people in my life who've become addicted to it. I think it has a real psychoactive effect. And there's mounting evidence that, you know, suggests that young people who have started smoking it at a young age, and it's increasingly happening at a younger and younger age, it's having an effect, changing the way their brains work. So apparently it doesn't have such a bad effect if you're smoking it sort of after the age of 21 and you're only doing it in moderation. But young people smoking it in their adolescent youth, it's terrible. And I'll say this, there's always somebody who says, oh no, weed's great for you. Weed's great for you. It's wonderful. You know,
that's always a cope. Everyone's got their copes. Everyone's got a reason for why the drug that they love so much is actually good for them. You know, so yeah, I've known many people who have smoked a lot of marijuana as well. Like, I grew up in a less than affluent area, a lot of broken families, kids without fathers and so forth, kids that were into crime. What I noticed is for the first year or two, it didn't really seem like a big deal. It just made them more relaxed. They laughed a lot. They were funny. They were cool. But then after that couple of years, always the same effects, they started shrinking. They didn't come to events anymore. Their energy was smaller. People forgot about them. And if they were there, you didn't notice them. They just kind of sat by themselves in the corner as though they weren't even there at all. They might as well not even been at an event, even if it was like a family event, if it was a family member. I think marijuana kills your charisma, shrinks your energy, makes you into a non-entity where people just start to overlook you as though you're not even there. You become like almost transparent. It's not something you want to do to yourself.
Look, I know not everyone's going to like this, but I suppose I'm not the biggest people pleaser in the world, but I've always found it to be a really sort of obnoxious drug. And when people take it, it sort of has these two effects. Firstly, people who take it absolutely think it's this wonder drug. It cures anything. You know, you could be in a road traffic accident and break every bone in the lower half of your body, and some idiots will tell you that if you smoke weed, it'll fix it all. You know, you'll be back on your feet in 3 days if you smoke enough weed. But the second thing is, not only do people shill really hard for it, but actually everyone I know who has smoked the stuff regularly, it's had a really negative effect on them, and it makes them really mentally sluggish. They're not sharp, they're not on point, and eventually it begins to affect their willingness to do physical activity as well, and it becomes this sort of crutch where they're like, oh, you're a bit grouchy here. Oh, yeah, that's because I haven't had my weed. And yeah, I'm not a big fan of it, not a big fan of it at all. I don't like it. And I think it's going to be I think you're going to see in the next few decades it being a huge, huge problem. Glenn19 gave $2. Thanks so much. Said, Mr. Cottrell, isn't the strength of Jewish people their solidarity, not their racism? Their racism appears to be a weakness. Wherever people see them cheering about wanting to rape Goyim girls and drinking their blood, everyone wants to kill them. Look at what happened in the Netherlands recently.
Well, you know, wanting to kill or sacrifice children isn't really an expression of racism. I think that's more of some sort of underground ritual process. So, yeah, there's been a lot of aggressive backlash against the Jewish community throughout European history as a result of numerous activities that they've consistently engaged in, from human sacrifice to shaving gold coins down. That's one of the reasons they were kicked out of England historically. But I think racism we see in or through a negative lens, and that isn't necessary for us right now. What I'm trying to say here, sorry, I'm tired. Ever since I got back from England, I'll throw this in there, I've been having to work a lot because I realized I couldn't actually afford that trip. It really sent me broke. It was much more expensive than I thought it would be. I ended up spending a lot more money than I thought I would. So I've been working a lot and I'm been sleeping a lot, very tired. But I'm trying to get back on some top of my game. what I'm trying to say here is racism, all it means is ethnic solidarity at the end of the day, and prioritizing your own over people who are outside your ethnic group. Nepotism, or ethnic nepotism, you might say. And that is what the Jews owe a lot of their success in the world to, I think. They see themselves as a separate people, not just separate, but better. But they're not very overt about that point of view. They pretend to respect you. They pretend to treat you as though you're an equal. But it's all a front. They're actually prioritizing their own kind and their own interests at whatever cost. But they're doing that behind the front of appearing like an upstanding, respectful people. So it is deceptive, but it's been very effective for them. And it's kind of obvious when you think about it. I think if we emulate a similar level of racism, where ostensibly we're treating everybody with respect, but within and behind all of that activity, we're actually just trying to advance our own interests. That's the way politics is conducted. And that's the way to, well, you know, it's the way to victory, I suppose.
Thank you. Spartan Sadakar. Glenn 19 qualifies this with a further $2. He said, for example, with the war in Gaza, their war crimes and racist language Israelis use is causing people in Japan, Vietnam, and other countries in my region to dislike Jews. There have been attempts on Israeli tourists' lives in Vietnam and Japan. It just creates anti-Semitism. I see what he's saying. Spartan Sadakar gave $2. Thank you so much. He said, in Poland, they are trying to push Poland to shoot down Russian missiles over Ukraine, which would be a serious escalation. They are just using the ads as an excuse to push brainwashing. No way that sells cars. It does the opposite for most. Well, thank you so much. Jagdeep Jaina gave $15. Thank you so much. And he said, I can't be the only one who thinks that Hunky Blair the Bear would make a great mediator and peace and peacemaker in the sizzling hot beef between the fiery, passionate otter Thomas Sewell and the stubborn, indignant twink Mark Collett. How did the feud even start? There isn't a feud. Look, I've gone through this quite a few times about the Thomas Sewell thing. I don't have any beef with Thomas Sewell. In fact, and I certainly don't want him to go to jail or anything bad to happen to him. In fact, you know, I like a lot of his work. There was a minor issue at one point between me and Thomas because he came on a show that was aligned with my organization and said some pretty crazy stuff that could get our people into trouble. Obviously, at that point, I've got to disavow that because it's something we don't agree with and we don't believe, but I've got no ill will towards him. And if Thomas Sewell sort of, you know, jumped on Skype after this show and wanted to talk to me, I would talk to him. I wouldn't turn him away. I don't have any beef with him. No ill will whatsoever. I mean, Blair, you've had, you know, you're friends with Thomas Sewell. You know, you can pass the message on. There is no ill will between me and Thomas. Everyone's happy. Oh, God, this is awful news. $5 has just come from Dare Cheruska. He said, I just read the sad news that Ursula Haverbeck has passed away. Ursula Haverbeck being the 96-year-old German lady who, despite the German state's repeated attempts to silence her, she always stood up against them and, fought them all the way. And steadfastly refused to bow down to the German state when it came to issues of the truth regarding the Holocaust. I don't know how much you know about her, Blair, but that's incredibly sad news. She lived to 96. You know, God rest her soul. She was a great woman who fought for the truth. And
is that the old lady that the German government sent to jail for questioning the Holocaust? I think she went a couple of times, didn't she? Because even after she'd been to jail once, she still said, look, it's not true. What they're telling you is not true. So they sent her back to jail again, this old lady. Yeah.
Yep. That's the one. You know, obviously, you know, she's, you know, she had an incredible life where, you know, she fought them, all the way, and sadly she's now passed away, but I hope somebody gives a fitting tribute to her.
I think there was a strong effort of deterrence there by the legal system in Germany. The message they were sending to the German public, I suppose, is, hey, we'll even send these old ladies to jail if they don't go along with the Holocaust narrative. So if that's what we're going to do to old ladies, imagine what we'll do to you young people. You know, so that was the deterrence, I suppose.
No, that's right. And look, I've got to say this. A lot of people sort of balk at the idea of putting their life on the line for a cause, or not even their life on the line, just giving up their freedom for a cause. And I remember a picture of Ursula Haverbeck, and she was stood with a little old-fashioned brown leather suitcase with her clothes in it, getting ready to go to prison. And she stood there smiling and waving with this grin on her face. And I looked at her and I thought, you know what? There's going to be all these daft people out there who say, oh my God, they're taking away her freedom. You know, this is awful. I'd never dare do that. You know, what kind of lunatic does that and goes to jail? But when I saw her smile, I actually saw somebody who was fundamentally free, more free than all those people who refused to open their mouths and speak the truth. You know,
that is true, definitely. There's something about prison I miss. I did some prison when I was young. I miss the simplicity of it, I suppose. And I felt like I went to jail just because I stood up for something that I thought was right at the time. It wasn't political, it was personal. So I suppose I've had a history of doing that. But yeah, jail's not that bad, not in my experience. And sometimes, by speaking the truth and suffering the consequences, you do die happier, or you do just experience a level of liberation, a level of freedom on the inside that other people really can't fathom. And so I suppose for ordinary people, when they see this old lady who's questioned the Holocaust going to jail and smiling about it, that's what she's experiencing inside. She's experiencing a sense of liberation because she is just told the truth. That's all she's done, has told the truth as she sees it. And so she feels inside herself an experience of freedom that the ordinary person doesn't understand.
Yeah, and I've just looked up, I'm not sure if I'll be able to find the actual picture, but I've just looked up Ursula Haverbeck smiling. And even as an old lady, she had this cute little smile, and she would always be, you know, even when she was in court, even when they were throwing everything at her, she was always smiling. I don't know where I saw this picture of her with the suitcase, but I remember it, unless my mind's just sort of made up and it's a composite image. But
was Ursula ever, is that her name, Ursula?
Yeah.
Was she ever married?
I don't know.
I was going to say, maybe she lost her husband in the war, and so she just thought, you know, I don't care anymore, something like that. That would make sense. Just trying to understand her motivations. But maybe it was just for the experience of the freedom to just speak the truth, because that's the truth as she saw it.
Yeah, she's a real hero. Mycroft Wins gave $37. Thank you so much for your generosity. He says, Blair, are you Scots, Irish, or German? What are your bloodlines?
Irish and German. Obviously with some Anglo thrown in there too. But yeah, my mum's side goes back to Irish and dad's goes to German on his mother's side. It's sort of eventual. We've been in Australia for a while. I think we are not, we weren't, I don't know if we were First Fleet. That would be pretty extreme if we were. It'd be pretty impressive if we survived since then. But we were pretty, we arrived in Australia and grabbed some land pretty early. But the way my family lost a lot of the land, well, my immediate family lost a lot of the land and wealth that we accumulated early on, is because back in early days in Australia, landowners and farmers were quite wealthy, powerful, and they arranged marriages with other landowners. So my grandfather or great-grandfather, I think, was supposed to marry a daughter from another prestigious landowner family, farming family. But he fell in love with a poor girl from the city, and so he ran away to marry her. And I come from that decision. So we had to start from scratch. But there are some people with my surname spelt the same way down here in Australia who are quite wealthy and prestigious as a result of staying within the family's marriage plans. So I don't know. I suppose you could say that I extend from that rebellious nature.
Well, you're certainly a rebel. Night Nation Review gave $5. Thank you so much. And he has sent links to the documentaries Jewish Ritual Murder. They're currently hosted on Twitter. So thank you for that. You can grab those links there. And Mycroft Wins gave another $37. Thank you so much. And he sent a link to Jared Taylor's Esoteric Hyperborean Workout. God, I'm watching him do these press-ups. They're the weirdest. I'm not doing those press-ups. I'm not going to watch the whole video, but like that, yeah, I'm not doing those press-ups. Thank you for the $37, Mycroft Wins. I'm not doing that. They don't even look like press-ups. He's just lying in the grass, sort of like, that's strange. I've never seen anything like. I'm gonna question Jared on this next week. And Mycroft Wins gave another $6. Thank you so much. He said, let's top this off. Well, thank you so much for your generosity tonight. You've been incredibly generous. Thank you so much. And obviously, you know, if you do get in touch, you've been very generous throughout the year. If there's obviously anything you'd ever like to speak to me about, please feel free to. Scaredy Cat gave $4. Thank you so much. Said, hi, Blair and Mark. Best wishes. Well, best wishes to you. Woodlander gave $5. Thank you so much, my friend. He said, just wanted to say thank you to Blair for making the effort to come to the UK and speak with us. You got to meet the Woodlander.
Yeah, I did. It was an interesting bloke. He was passionate, I could tell. And I could tell he's someone who's like well established within your community up there too, because a lot of people had a lot of respect for Woodlander. And I think I found him on Telegram as well. I don't know if I already followed him, or I definitely follow him now. But yeah, thanks, mate, for the appreciation. And it was great to meet you.
It was. It was a real lineup. It was a really amazing lineup. The we didn't get Woodlander in the picture because he had to shoot off on the Saturday at the end. But we got a great picture of you, me and Sasha all having a beer together. And I've got to say, Sasha and you, either side of me, I look like a little boy compared to both. Sasha,
from certain angles, Sasha even makes me look small. I mean, the guy's just got those huge bones. He's just got that big, even his hands, when he shakes your hand,
he's like got a bear, massive
German hands. And he used to do a lot of like exercise, fighting, I think mixed martial arts and stuff. So, you know, he's no stranger to physical brawn, you know.
No, Sasha is absolutely huge. He's a formidable guy, and he's always so jolly as well. Because you look at Sasha, and he's got that look where you know he could drink his weight in beer, eat his weight in steak, and then probably knock five or six guys out just for fun. But he's the most sort of he's such a friendly, jolly fella.
He's intelligent too. He's intelligent. He believes in a version of nationalism, which is kind of spawning out of a understanding of economic policy, which is something that I can't relate to. I'm not an economist, but he's someone who's really thought about policy change in favor of nationalism. He's an intelligent guy in addition to all of this. So it was really good to meet him as well.
Indeed. The Resident Baker gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, hi, Mark. Great show and great guests. Well, thank you very much. Jacob gave $5. This is one for you, Blair. And he says, Blair, I recently broke up with my girlfriend and she was adamant she didn't want kids. And we are both in our late 20s. What's the best advice you can give for getting over someone?
Ooh. Well, it really depends on the person, how old you are. I suppose this person said they were late 20s. If you're hung up on someone as a man, that's very, it's indicative that you're still young and fresh in the mind. Because as a man, you shouldn't really be too beholden to a woman in an emotional sense. You should have your own stuff going on, your own goals, your work, your personal ambitions, and they should take priority over any woman or female interest that you have. And actually, women will respect you more if you're paying more attention to achieving something in your life than you are paying attention to them. For example, if you were interested in winning this girl's affections again, The fact that she never wanted kids is kind of, that's a bit of an issue in the first place, because any woman who really likes you, genuinely likes you and appreciates you, you're going to spawn in that woman an interest or a desire to have children with you. She's going to want to do that. That's part of her natural organic response to liking a man. So that's kind of an issue. Maybe it was never meant to be in the beginning if she never wanted to have kids with you. My best advice to you would be to learn from the experience and move on. But even if you were interested in winning this woman's affections again, the best way to do that is actually to focus on something that's not her and busy yourself in the pursuit of whatever that is. Become successful in whatever it is that you're trying to pursue, or at least advertise that you're free, that you're happy, that you're doing well. And, you know, maybe she'll get in touch with you again. But it's best to cut your losses, mate. Like, what do you think, Mark?
I'm not going to say anything. No, I'm going to zip. Whenever I give relationship advice, people always get really angry because it's sort of it's on the nose and it always works. I'm going to, I'll say this to you, Jacob. What you need to do is basically ignore her. Women love being ignored.
They say they don't, but it
drives them mental, mate.
It hurts them in a way that they come to love, I think. I don't know what it is.
If you've got, I'll tell you this now, the minute you chase a woman and give in to her, that's the moment she loses all respect for you. You want to ignore her, pretend she never existed, and she will either come back and yield to all of your demands. But in the meantime, just head out there and find someone else and get over it and move on. That's the best. The worst thing you can do as a man is sit around thinking about your ex. Three things you need to do. Number one, ignore her. Number two, go out, do physical exercise, plenty of fresh air, see your friends, keep your mind off it. And number three, start the search for someone else. Do those three things. You'll emerge the winner one way or another.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes it's easier said than done, and it's normal to feel a bit upset about the situation. Try not to avoid that despair. Sink into it. Find some time to just be with yourself and feel that sadness. Don't distract yourself from it. Feel it, because by feeling it and experiencing it, you're kind of getting through it. You need to pass through that grief. But you shouldn't be afraid to be alone as a man. Time is on your side as a man. The world is yours. You can do whatever you want, go wherever you want at whatever time. And you should appreciate the time you get to yourself, believe me, because when you start to get a bit older and you find yourself married, tied down with kids, you probably don't find as much time to have with yourself as you would like to have. So you should appreciate that time while you do have it. Don't worry about being alone for a while as a man. It's a good thing.
Agreed. Maybe next time, go $3. Thank you so much. It said, hail Ursula Haverbeck. Thank you very much. $14 came from Stan One. Thank you very much. It said, glad Blair made it to the West Country of these Isles. Thank you very much. Poit gave $25 and simply said, donation. Thank you very much. We're switching over now to the Entropy Super Chat. Wife Waffen gave $8. Thank you so much. She said, have a great week. Well, thank you so much, my dear. Raven Keeper gave $10. Thank you very much. And said, thank you both for your excellent work. Blair, do you have any favorite leg exercises?
Yeah, I really like belt squats. It's not a machine that you would typically find in a standard gym, but they're becoming a little more popular, at least in the gyms around where I live. But if you look up the belt squat, there's a belt that goes around your waist just above your hips and a chain attached to the front of it, which hooks onto a mechanism upon which you load the weight. And so rather than the bar sitting on my back, which me being a taller guy, it's not really efficient for me to be going really heavy on a standard barbell squat. But my quads really like the squat movement and I respond really well to it. But due to how long my legs are, it's a bit awkward for me to really load a lot of weight onto the barbell squat. And leg press, it's all right, but it just doesn't hit the same way. So I was looking, you know, years ago for a way to do squats easier. There was hack squat machines. They were okay. But for me, nothing's better than the belt squat. I can position my feet more to the back of the platform you stand on when you do the belt squat, which concentrates a lot more of the force directly on the quads. Or if I position my feet more to the front of the platform, then I can sink myself lower into the squat, causing my glutes to engage more, a little bit more hamstring as well. So there's different variations you can make, and you don't have to worry about that perfect form of motion with the barbell squat. And for me, like I said, being a taller guy, that's amazing. So yeah, I can't recommend the belt squat enough, especially for taller guys.
Excellent. Ant Sally gave $5. Thank you so much, my dear. He says, looking forward to tonight's stream. It was such a privilege to meet Blair IRL at their recent PA conference. I'm still quite chuffed, to be honest. Then she put a little smiley face with love hearts in the eyes. You were definitely definitely a favourite of the females. I feel I've been usurped now, Blair. You arrived and you conquered the hearts of the PA ladies, leaving Marky C with no remaining love.
Oh, I don't think that's true. I saw plenty of women looking at you with starry eyes as well, mate.
Thank you. VM gave $3. Thank you so much. And said, God bless Blair. Great seeing him recently. We need a movement of Giga Chads by highly adaptive body and soul. For both, we need a liftocracy. The more you lift, more correct your opinions are. Well, thank you so much. David Peterson gave $10. Thank you so much. He said, the N word. It's a bit like McDonald's. You want the real thing, but for whatever reason, you're left with something that really doesn't satisfy you. Am I right? Well, thank you for that, David.
On the subject of McDonald's, let me say I had McDonald's in England and I couldn't eat it. I don't know whether I just got a bad burger, but I could not eat it. And that's saying something for me because I'll eat anything. I couldn't get the meat down. It was stale. It was just old and hard. I couldn't eat it. And I've never had that experience at a McDonald's in Australia. In Australia, the McDonald's is always edible. The meat's good. So I'm sorry to say, but I think despite England having the greenest pastures I've ever seen and the happiest cows who produce probably the best quality of dairy in the world, I think England must be selling all its best beef and just, I don't know, maybe importing cheap, shitty beef from somewhere else. So maybe McDonald's in England is doing that. I don't know what the deal is, but McDonald's in England was inedible.
You know what? This is really interesting. I think we're going down a rabbit hole here, Blair. This stream's going to be an hour now of us discussing McDonald's. I'll tell you this. I've got a friend who is a powerlifter, and he goes around the world competing in powerlifting competitions. And he came to the UK, and we were going to eat. And I said, do you fancy grabbing a McDonald's? And he says, I'll never eat McDonald's. They're disgusting. They make me sick. You know, everyone knows you avoid McDonald's in America. And I said, oh, well, look, I'm going to McDonald's whether you like it or not. So he was like, well, I'm going to have a burger then. So he had a burger and he was like, that's the best burger I've ever had at a McDonald's. It's completely different to American McDonald's. He said, American McDonald's is complete filth. I can't eat it. But your McDonald's is fantastic. And when I went to Mexico, I went into a McDonald's and it was inedible. I mean, it was absolutely disgusting. And that means that maybe I'm not at the top of the mountain. You're at the top of the McDonald mountain in Australia. You've got like a good, so because the Americans think our McDonald's is like much nicer than theirs, but you're saying yours is much nicer than ours. So like there's like this McDonald iceberg or mountain, and there is definitely a peak.
I can't confirm that though. It might have just been one bad experience, you know, because I only tried it once. But, you know, even the KFC, though, in England was weird. You got those rice boxes where there's like a chopped zinger fillet on top of rice with some salad. And we don't have that here. We just have burgers and chicken. And you also, I noticed in KFC in England, they don't shave their potatoes on the chips. The skin is still on the chips.
Yes, skin, which is another little
weird difference because they skin all the potatoes here in Australia. So all these little differences you notice when you go to another country.
Well, I'll tell you this. McDonald's is one thing in the UK. It's been quite consistent. But KFC is the pits. Now, when you used to go to KFC in the UK, you get a burger and the bun would be like that, but the chicken would be like sticking out at both ends. Like the chicken was markedly bigger than the bun. And if you went for a KFC and you had a KFC, you would feel so good eating it, but you'd feel so dirty afterwards. You'd be like, oh my God, what have I done to myself? There's so much. I went for a KFC recently and they're tiny now. And I just gobbled it up. But one of my friends who is a regular at PA events, and he always he donates on these streams, he's been pestering me for ages. He's like, go to Popeye's Chicken. You've got to go to Popeye's Chicken. And I was like, I'm not going to Popeye's Chicken. And he's like, look, there's one near me. If you drive over, I'll pay, but you've got to try it. So I was like, well, okay, you're buying me the Popeye's, so let's go. And I've got to say, Popeye's Chicken is just amazing. It's like what used to be. Popeye's Chicken in this country, there's just, each burger has got two chicken fillets in it. It was just amazing.
We don't have Popeye's here. And because I made a point of trying some different food chains while I was there because I was just interested. Popeye's Chicken, man, it sucked. It was like KFC from Wish. I can't agree. I still think the KFC in England was better than Popeye's. Again, maybe it was just one bad experience, but I was really disappointed in Popeye's Chicken. I've seen it plugged in an Adam Sandler movie. What was it? Little Nicky. And I've just always wanted to try it, but we don't have it here. So I got the opportunity, didn't like it. Didn't even finish it, actually. I threw out some chicken, some extra tenders that I got because I just couldn't get them down. So can't agree.
Well, I think it might be this, Blair. It might be that you were jet lagged, or you see, and this is the other thing in the UK, and this is something that you've got to factor in. Now, in the UK, all these companies are franchises. Now, they do buy everything from a central distributor, but you do get better examples depending on who's running the franchises. But yeah, when it comes down to it, I'm one of these freaks who can pretty much eat anything. Like if you said to me, like, we're going to Ratty Burger and it's literally like three dead rats, like deep fried, put in a burger, I would try it. And I'd probably come out and be like, yeah, that was all right. I'd do it again. It's like, you know, on some things I've got like really high standards, but when it comes to fast food, I'm pretty lax on my fast food.
You look like you've got a fast metabolism though. You can probably put away a bit of food and not really suffer any weight gain, right?
Yeah, and I eat like a pig. So generally speaking, when I go out for meals, people are surprised at how quick I can eat and how much I can put away quickly. So no one's been able to beat me that I know eating four Big Macs in a row. Most people tap out at about three, but I'll have four Big Macs in maybe 6 minutes. You know, I'm a very, very quick eater. I also did a raw egg eating competition once as well. They threw up after like two eggs and I was on my foot. I just drank them. I was just, you know, just nothing really. I didn't even think it was a competition. It just down the hatch, off they go. I suppose, you know, the good thing is if there ever was a zombie apocalypse, I'd be the kind of person that just be eating corpses and I'd be fine. You
know? Yeah, we have that in common, I think. I'm much the same. messy. Eat too fast. I just enjoy food too much, you know, and then I kind of, it's actually difficult for me. It pains me to eat slowly. It's like agonizing. I have to eat fast to enjoy it, you know.
The worst thing is, oh God. When I go out places, I am disgraceful and my missus has to tell me. So we sort of went out with her family the other day and they were like, oh, we'll take you to this nice place for lunch. And I saw these two sort of fat women who'd ordered this massive platter of cakes. And I was looking at the cakes and my missus was looking at me like, don't even think about it. And my missus' parents like, what's wrong? And she's like, well, if they leave the cakes, he's going to snatch them. He will snatch the cakes. And they're like, he surely doesn't do things like this. And I'm like, yeah, I absolutely do. I will eat anything. I'll eat like a pig. And if I walk past like a platter of cakes that somebody's left, as long as they've not been, you know, as long as no one's gnawed on them or anything, I will snatch. sort of uneaten food at restaurants.
Have you ever been at a restaurant and you've seen someone at another table that's only eaten like a third of their meal and then they've gotten up and left? And you're sitting there having finished your meal or something and you're looking over at that table and you're thinking, oh, I wish I could just go over and eat that. I want to eat that. And then you see the waitress take it away and you know they're going to throw it out and you're thinking, oh, what a waste.
I'd have eaten it, mate. We went somewhere the other day and we don't go eat out often. So actually it wasn't the other day. It was a good few months back. And like a pint of Coke was like £4 or £5. So it was incredibly expensive. And this couple ordered dessert and she ordered like a pint of Coke with the dessert, like another Coke. And just didn't drink it and left it there. And I just said to my missus, there's no way is that Coke getting left. I'm not paying £5 for another Coke. I'm having that. And she's like, you are literally the worst. She's like, you, I can't take you anywhere. So like when we ever go out with like family or friends, I'm sort of like, she's there with the electric cattle prod under the table, getting ready to tase me in case I act up in some kind of way, which I think is perfectly acceptable, but she finds just horrific. Are you that kind of embarrassing man, or can you control yourself? Because I've got no self control.
I've got plenty of. I need a lot of self control to contain what I want to say and do most of the time. So yeah, I'm someone that you can trust will keep up appearances and present themselves well enough, you know.
Good. Flying Dutchman gave $20. Thank you so much. And he said, good show. Thank you so much. And David gave $20. Thank you very much. He said, yes, I agree. One of the main reasons we are living in the degenerate dystopian current times is the gene pool we lost in World War One and World War Two. Well, thank you so much. Scaredy Cat gave $4. Thank you very much. He said, hi again, Blair and Mark. Canada has now surpassed India in Sikhization of their culture, with 2.1% of Canadians being Sikh versus 1.7% of Sikhs in India. Spreading elsewhere, 21 million Sikhs in India, 750,000 Sikhs in Canada, 500,000 Sikhs in India, and 250,000 Sikhs in Italy and Australia. Thank you so much. That's weird, isn't it? There's a higher percentage of Sikhs in Canada than there is in India. That is how mental our immigration system is. Jacob gave $25. Thank you so much. He said, thanks for the response. Well, thank you for asking the question and for your generosity. Alf the Nemesis gave $5. Thank you so much. Said, burgers don't have chicken, Mark Collett. That's a chicken sandwich. Popeyes is great Zog Chow. Yeah, we don't call them chicken sandwiches. We call them chicken burgers here in the UK. So there's...
same for us. Yeah, burgers.
Yeah. $1 from the Resident Baker. Thank you so much. Said, I can confirm Mark Collett will clean anyone's plate. Yeah, the Resident Baker's a peer activist. He's been with me at dinners where... people have left like, you know, half a pie or something like that. And I've just been like, throw it my way. people in the chat are going to be like, this guy, he's meant to be like a leader. He's meant to be inspiring us. And he's basically going to invite us all to a restaurant, then finish off our plates.
I'm waiting for the day where that shameful surprise picture is taken of Mark, like waiting out the back of a bakery to get all the bread and stuff that they're throwing out at the end of the day. And he's like, you know, he's busted.
I would do it. I actually know a guy who used to go to supermarkets when supermarkets kept their skips outside. They now keep their skips behind, like in a sealed area. And he used to buy these special keys that open supermarket skips, and he would go there and just get out of date meat, veg, anything they would throw out. He would dive in the skip and he'd take it home, and if it smelled all right, he'd cook it and he'd eat it. You know, I'd join him.
Whatever works. How are we going? I've got to slip off to work.
Two more super chats. JQRC gave $5. Thanks so much. Says, hail to the Aussie King. And he gave a little man with an arm up in the air. And Deck WBA18 gave $1. Thank you so much. He said, what would you guys advise for young men in their 20s struggling to get employment with no direction? Very quickly, my advice is the following. Register for unemployed and literally do any course they give you for free as registered for unemployed. So when you're unemployed, the government will have loads of schemes, adult education, training, seminars, everything for you that you wouldn't normally get if you were in, if you weren't registered as unemployed. Get on that ladder, learn something new, and they will get you back to work. Anyway, Blair, I can see you're itching to get off. Do you want to say your goodbyes and then I'll shut things down? Thank you so much for being here. And
yeah, no, it's fine. It's fine. Like, in regards to advice for young guys too that don't have jobs, no direction, I would do an apprenticeship as an electrician, carpenter, plumber, more for the building the work ethic and learning a valuable skill that you can always trade in the future to make yourself a quid. If you're really struggling, you don't have to stick with that trade forever, but the kind of work ethic that you build by doing a trade young, because you'll be worked pretty hard, that's invaluable. And that carries over into other aspects of your life in the future. And you'll always apply yourself to a greater degree than you otherwise would have if you didn't do the apprenticeship young. And an apprenticeship young, when you're in your teenage years, it's almost like being in the army. You've got to get up really early. You've got to work really hard and you've got to do it every day on a schedule. It really builds a strong work ethic. So that's what I could recommend. But yeah, I've got to shoot off to work now. Well, it's been a good stream. I've had a great time.
Thank
it's
you
great
so much.
To speak to Mark
as
always.
Yourself.
Speak thanks to you for soon. Thanks, everyone. Thank See you later.
Cheers. We've got one more super chat from Scaredy Cat. Thank you so much. She gave $4 and said, hi, third time, Blair and Mark. Monoculture is what we must fight for. India's Hindus and Sikhs have reached giddy heights of success in the Anglosphere due to the wrong promotion of assimilation. Indians with an advantage of colonization compared to Arabs and other Muslims who are happy with their own languages and lands. Well, thank you so much. And thank you to Blair. We are going to shut things down now. We've got to the end of the stream. But I do have some good news with you. For those who are still here, don't shut the stream down just yet. I've got one last piece of good news before we end things. I spoke to a lady yesterday whose husband has been jailed for 3 years for being part of the disturbances following the Southport murders. They've got two children together. She's having to take time off work. And Laura's just messaged me saying, we've just allocated them £2,000 right now. So to close things down on a high point, that is what we're all about. That's some good news. That is our prisoner support fund working for the people who need it most. So there's some final good news before we shut it down. Well, look, thanks to Blair. He's been brilliant as always. Absolutely great man. Love him to bits. Thank you to everyone who donated so very generously throughout this stream. I cannot thank you enough. Your generosity means that I can keep doing the things that I'm doing, doing all the things that Blair explained that I do, and also doing things like this prisoner support fund. You know, I do speak to these families and, you know, I'm working as hard as I can to make sure there's a support network there for people who need it most within our community. I'm going to be back on Friday with my pre-recorded video, back on Friday with Dr. David Duke, back on Sunday with Keith Woods, back next week with Jared Taylor for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. There's absolutely loads going on. Again, huge thank you to Blair. Thank you to everyone who donated so generously. But the biggest thank you, as always, goes to this amazing community. Thank you so much. I love you all. And I'll see you same time next week for another episode of Patriotic Weekly Review. Thank you, everybody, and good night.